UK Wine Show, show number 221, Wrexham Cairns with Graham Fenton. Good day to you all out in Podland, and sounds a bit like Poundland, but materially more solid. So solid, in fact, we're looking at the aluminium as a way of holding wine. So light, it's used from aircraft to cans. And it's cans that we're looking at with Wrexham Cairns, who've been putting wine into cans since Paris Hilton pushed a gold-coloured Prosecco can onto a surprised world. We talk with Graham Fenton from Wrexham Cairns on why he thinks aluminium is so suitable as a storage for wine. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we've got Jane back from holidaying in Australia with the girls as our loft continues. Last week I spent about 30 hours painting upstairs, trying to make it look beautiful for their return. And even new windows are in place, so it's all looking very nice indeed. As usual, we've got a packed show, starting off with our mystery wine region. And this week, as usual, I'm going to give you a clue now. I'm going to give you a clue before the interview and the answer at the end of the show. So this week's mystery wine region is a Chilean region, and it's the source of the majority of the country's wines. It's a 1,000-kilometre-long plateau which is separated from the Pacific Ocean to the west by a low coastal range of peaks, while to the east it has the mighty Andes rising up to 6,000 metres. Vines are at altitude up to 600 metres on the western slopes and up to 1,000 metres on the sunnier eastern side. It's thought that vines were brought here as early as 1554 by Spanish settlers, partly so they could make wine which to celebrate the Eucharist. Today, however, a different set of grapes of varieties are grown. Red grapes such as Cabernet Sauvignon, Carmenere, Merlot, and Syrah dominate. But Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay are also more important. I'm going to give you another set of clues after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. The Australian wine company Rivers Wine that sold fake Chardonnay juice has been fined more than $350,000 Australian dollars, that's about £200,000, of which $50,000 is to be paid by the former boss Andrew Hashin. The company in fact sold Sultana juice to major wine companies including Hardy's, claiming it was Chardonnay. At the time, Chardonnay grapes were worth around four times the price of Sultana. According to reports, Rivers Wine is now in liquidation and Hashim is bankrupt and cannot pay the fine.
It's a bit of a problem when the world's largest and most sophisticated wine company can't tell the difference between Chardonnay and Sultanas. But at the bottom end of production, the resulting wine is a function more of the winemaker than the fruit. And I guess this proves it more than anything else. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, a new hierarchy for Languedoc appellations has been confirmed, with two new tiers forming a pyramid structure for the region. The new tiers will sit above AOC Languedoc wines and will be known as the Grand Vin de Languedoc and Grand Cru de Languedoc. Existing appellations have been categorised into the new tiers in a bid to raise the profile of quality wines from the region. Each category will have strict appellation rules to control the quality and the quantity of the wine produced, as well as promotional programmes to boost sales.
New AOC structures may not suit everybody. One of the reasons Languedoc has improved so much in quality in the last 20 years has been the ability to experiment within the Van der Pays environment. Whether the AOC is more of a formulation of what worked or restrictions to limit experimentation, time will tell. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, finally this week, the practice of adding water to grape must, which is banned throughout Europe, could become legal in South Africa if proposals are given the go-ahead by the South African government. The proposal has been passed by South Africa's Wine and Spirit Board and could become law by the end of 2011. Producers say the aim is to improve quality, not increase volume, as well as meet a growing trend for lower alcohol wines. If it goes ahead, the wines would be illegal in Europe. And according to the UK Wine and Spirit Trade Association, it's highly unlikely that EU laws will change. Current EU laws permit the reduction of alcohol levels by up to 2% using spinning cone and reverse osmosis technology. That's it from me, but don't forget to check out these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
I don't think it's going to go ahead. If it is legal in South Africa, but not in the EU, I don't think it'll make much difference. That said, if you give the grapes a good spray of water just before you pick them, you'd be surprised how much extra water makes it into the grapes and into the must, all perfectly legal. But given the choice of wine made with spinning cone, that is, being split and reformed, versus watered down, I think I'd go for the watered down. But this is not likely to be possible since the EU suffers from too much production and dropping consumption levels in the EU, which means that creating more wine by watering them down, which is even less likely, irrespective of the quality issues. In South Africa, oversupply is not a problem, and it's a valid option. It's a shame the EU problems are going to limit winemaking flexibility, but maybe they should pick a bit earlier and not have such high sugar levels in their fruit. Or maybe change the grape varieties so that they're more suited to the environment. There are a couple of other options you can always go for. Okay, that finishes up the news. Next up, we have our spotlight. And this week, we continue looking at how to work out what a mystery grape variety is or spotting a blind wine. And we're going to be doing that by trying to work out the age of the wine that we're looking at. By now, we should have a rough idea of the grape variety and a broad idea of the location, or at least the climate that the wine's been made. But firstly, we need to determine the maturity. Then, thinking about the grape variety and the structure, we can get an idea of the vintage. Perhaps the best indicator of maturity is colour. As red wines age, they often start out blue or reddish, depending on the grape variety and the winemaking technique, and then pass through a bricky red, garnet, and finally going towards tawny and brown. White wines often start out clear, or perhaps with a green tinge, before becoming darker and more golden, finally ending up in an amber colour for very old wines. In general, red wines get lighter as they get older, and white wines get darker. Now, the initial and final colour of the wine is adjusted based on the acidity in the wine, the sulfur dioxide in the wine, and winemaking techniques. For example, the depth of colour for a red wine may initially be very deep. This could be because of small or thick-skinned grapes giving quite a high skin-to-juice ratio and hence dark colour. Or it could be because the skin's been left to soak for a very long time on the juice. Young white wines can be quite bright golden in colour if the wine's been matured in an oak barrel. The barrel giving the wine's colour, and often giving it a vanilla for French oak or a coconut flavour maybe for an American oak. White wines that have been barrel fermented often are a bit lighter in colour, and the vanilla-y coconut flavours are less obvious. It's because the colour gets bound up by the yeast in the wine and gets removed when you remove the dead yeast from the barrel. Acidity also adjusts colour. Red wines with low pH, that's high acidity, are often very bright and red. This is because red colour can only exist in low pHs, high acidity. And as the pH rises, the red anthocyanins fade out. As the wines age, the acidity appears to fade, although technically it doesn't. What happens is the development of esters hide the acidity, which is relatively static. The speed that the wine ages is driven significantly by the pH of the wine. With many of the key aging reactions occurring more slowly in a wine with a low pH, that's high acidity. It's always quite confusing that, isn't it? A low pH is quite high acidity and a high pH is quite low acidity, with 7 being neutral, no acidity, or alkaline, the opposite. Alcohol in young wines is often hidden by the fruit flavours, which can become more noticeable towards the end of the wine's life as the fruit flavours drop away. Tannins are another good measure of determining the age or maturity of the wine. Young red wines can have quite harsh or firm tannins, and as these tannins polymerise, that's joined together, they become softer and more rounded. Eventually, they'll become so large that they come out of the wine and form a dark reddish-brown sediment in the wines, and the colour of the wines lighten as well. Be careful, not all sediment is polymerised tannins. Some sediment can be from grape skins and dead yeast cells, and winemakers who don't filter can sometimes leave sediment in young wines. This can be a sign of quality, or at least a boutique nature of the wine producer, as most industrial winemaking is filtered within an inch of its life. So, young red wines tend to have a purple or bright red colour, with young wines destined for ageing having significant acidity and high tannins. As the colour fades and turns brown, the acidity and tannins will soften, or perceived to be softening. Red wines with low acidity and tannins, and with a blue or bright red colour, will tend to be more commercial in nature and be quite young. Red wines that have turned bricky red and still have quite high levels of acidity are likely to be ageing quite slowly and quite old, as the acidity is slowing down that ageing process. But the wine has undergone significant development. Similarly, a gun or tawny wines with acidity levels still evident, again, is likely to be much older than similar coloured wine with very soft acidity. Again, because that acidity slows the process down. White wines that age will oxidise and change colour slowly, and any green tinges are definitely a sign of a young wine. A golden yellowing without that classic vanilla or coconut flavour to show that it's been aged in oak is likely to be older. Be careful though, there's some grape varieties such as Gewürztraminer which are naturally low in acidity and golden colour, which can be quite misleading. And the other one you need to be careful of is wines that have had a bit of botrytis. They also tend to be quite golden in colour, and all that sugar can hide the acidity somewhat. Perhaps the most useful point and the summary that I'd like to make this week is the colour of the wine and the acidity level combined can give you a fairly rough idea of the age of the wine. The more mature the colour and the higher acidity, the older the wine. Next week, we're going to be trying to work out how to price a wine. But pricing the wine isn't going to help you work out our mystery wine region. And I'm going to give you the second clue to our mystery wine region now. Now, our key wine region is divided up into subregions, four key subregions. They are Maipo, Rapal, Curico, and Mole, which in turn is divided into subregions such as Rapal's Colchagua Valley and Cachapol. Soils are varied and dependent on the area, and there are distinct climate variations. Generally, however, our Mystery Valley is Mediterranean with warm, dry summers and winter rainfall of between 300 and 800 millimetres, although this does tend to increase in the south and east on the slopes of the Andes. Apart from the spectacular scenery, the mountains also bring benefits for grape growing. For example, cold air drainage from the Andes at night causes great temperature variability in the east, which gives good levels of acidity and colour to the ripe grapes. Snowmelt from them, carried by the various rivers that dissect the valley, also provides irrigation during the growing season. That's the last clue. You should be able to get it, possibly. It is quite hard because most of the time in Chile, you think of those subregions such as Rapal or Colchagua as the regions themselves rather than subregions of this large main region. But how we think about it, I'm going to give you the answer after our interview, which is coming up next with Graham Fenton. Graham works for Wrexham Cans, and he's going to be telling us all about how Wrexham Cans use their cans for wine. Let's have a listen to what Graham has to say.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Graham Fenton from Wrexham Cans. How are you, Graham?
Very well, thank you.
Almost
pleased to be
here. Excellent. We're going to be talking a wee bit about wine going into aluminium cans. Is it aluminium cans that you're proposing wine goes into?
Yes, it is. We're a can manufacturer and have can locations throughout the world. We make aluminium cans and steel cans, but wine is best suited for aluminium cans.
Okay, and just a bit about yourself, Graham. Are you a bit of a wine drinker?
I am a wine drinker. I like the wines that I like. I'm not a huge expert as such, but I have the favourite tipple.
What's that?
There's too many to name here, but I like all of the good wines.
I like all the good ones. Yeah, that's a fair comment. Okay. Wrexham Cans. How big are Wrexham Cans?
Wrexham is the largest two-piece can manufacturer in the world, and we have locations throughout the world in North America, South America, India, Europe, Russia, and other locations where there is packaging.
What's a two-piece can compared to what other type of can?
A two-piece can is a can that has no side seam, so you have the basic can without the end on, and then that is a container that is filled by the producer, and then the top, which we call an end, is then seamed on hermetically, so the whole product is sealed, and there's no weak point in the can at all.
I remember the old steel cans that had a seam down the side.
That's right.
And did it have a base as well, probably?
Yes, so they're called three-piece, because you have the body and two ends.
Okay, so you form a cylindrical, do you, and then you form a cylindrical as a single piece with an end
for three-piece, are you talking?
For a two-piece.
For two-piece, the basic can-forming mechanism is we have a flat sheet of metal. From that, we stamp out what we call a cup, which is like a shallow dish. The shallow dish then goes into a horizontal press that draws and wall irons the cup so that it gradually elongates the sidewalls. And then the final process is the spraying, printing, and then we put a flange on it, which means when the top goes on and it goes through the seamer, you get a nice seam, which forms the absolute seal for the product.
Oh, cool. Quick description of how to make a can.
Yeah, very quick.
Yeah, no, very good. Very good. I've done quite a bit with glass manufacturing, and if we find that wine cans become a huge thing, I might come and visit a factory.
Absolutely. You're always welcome.
Excellent. Why did you decide to maybe look at putting wine into cans? You've got a few products in cans already. We even saw some Prosecco that went into a gold can a few years ago. But what was the reasoning behind deciding to put a wine into a can?
Well, the can industry has always been perhaps accused wrongly, in my view, of not being particularly novel in its approaches. We're always looking for new markets. We saw that there was an interest for wine in cans, and we thought that it was an area that the wine industry had never really exploited. We think there's a real opportunity there for the wine industry to appeal to a wider section with a different channel than traditionally they would have done. So we thought we would test the waters and see how interested people were.
And the interest was?
And the interest was there immediately. We got some people taking it up. And I think the interest for us is then how can we get some of the better known wine brands interested in putting wine in cans and understanding that there is other opportunities for their marketing to tap into novel niche brands which may appeal to a younger age drinker than they currently have.
I can see some advantages with cans, but from your opinion, what are the key markets that you think a can is most suited for and why?
Well, I think there's quite a few markets that would be quite interesting to understand the potential for. We've done Vox Pops, looking at what people's interest is and how they think of the can. First of all, we think it appeals to a young age range between 18 and 36.
Sorry,
that's where we take the can out and approach people without rehearsal, as it were, to give it to them and then find out what they think about the product. So you get an instant reaction about, do they think that's good? Will it appeal to them? How would they see people using it? You can ask a number of questions, but it's literally doing it on the hoof, going up to people and asking them their opinions on that product.
Okay.
So the market, you know, we think 18 to 36-year-olds would be very interested in cans in a market. They already use cans a lot with all the products that are out there, all the energy drinks, you know, the standard products that are out there. So there's a really good opportunity for that. And then in terms of events, you know, there's picnics. Would people want a different wine each? And if so, then the can would make a good portion. You could have three cans. One white, one red, one rosé, if you wanted. You know, you can mix and match.
Okay. I'm a wee bit of a traditionalist. I like to think of myself as an innovator, but back there I like to drink wine out of a glass. But one of the things with cans is it does have the advantage that if you're at a summer picnic or, you know, a big concert or something like that where you're not allowed glass in,
yep,
then a can obviously has huge advantages over glass because you're not allowed it. So I better have my wine some way than not at all. But then you're competing with PETs as well. So, you know, polyethylene, PET.
Tetrathalate.
Yeah. What is it? Polyethylene?
Tetrathalate.
Tetrathalate. So do you see PET as a natural competitor to you, or do bottles as a competitor?
It is a competitor. But again, we think the can has got advantages that will allow it to hold its own in some of the markets. It fills very fast, so it has good economy of space on the shelf. It's light, so it's good economies of transport. It chills very quickly. It feels cold when you hold it, so you immediately know you've got a cold can of wine. But again, we're not suggesting that people would necessarily drink it straight from the can. I think it's equally good. You know, you take the container along and you would still have your glass, pour it into the glass and enjoy it. And
as a slightly traditionalist, I would never drink wine out of a can.
No.
But I'm quite happy pour it into a glass and drink it from a can. Would that be the way you're looking to position
it? Yes, absolutely. I think part of the appreciation of wine, I mean, the can would be perfect because it's the perfect advertising medium. We print all the way around the can. We can print in 6 colours. So the medium is there for the brand, but of course, when one has a wine glass, you like to see the colour, you like to get the aroma, And the enjoyment is sipping it from the glass. So we're not pretending it's you drink it straight out of the can and do away with that.
Oh, good. I'd be a bit worried about that. Okay. In terms of performance, let's compare it to, say, PET, and then we'll compare it to glass and bottle as well. PET, you mentioned a load of different stuff, but yeah, specifically, what is its key advantage over PET in your...
Well, the advantages for cans, as we see it, is the can is impermeable to oxygen or any other gases for that matter. So when the wine is put in the can, what's in the can stays in the can. There is no migration through the metal of anything. It keeps out any form of light and any form of UV rays. So it is the perfect product for preserving what's in the can. So it does a good job of making sure that the product is well protected.
It's almost the opposite of PET, where particularly in the small formats, and I've seen your cans, they're quite small, sort of almost a glass of wine type format. Small bottles of PET let a lot of oxygen in for the wine that they're trying to preserve, so they've got a very short shelf life. Whereas you're saying the aluminium can doesn't let any oxygen in at all.
No.
From a shelf life point of view, you've possibly got a longer shelf life.
Yes, I mean, we would offer, we do standard testing when we deal with new products just to make sure that the product's going to behave the way we expect it to in the can. And normally we would be offering a 12-month shelf life for the product.
Okay.
It would clearly stand longer than that, but we have to put a limit somewhere. So traditionally we put 12 months on something.
Do you
like
need
that.
To put a best before date? Because on wine bottles you don't.
No, I think with the can we would want to, simply because it's something that I think we wouldn't necessarily be able to store it forever. We don't know how that would react over time. And the can we are really marketing as more of a short-term, ready-to-drink type product with a shorter shelf life, and to get the turnover in the type of markets we're talking about.
Sure.
So we wouldn't be laying down good wines and putting them in the cellar in cans.
Okay. What about versus glass then, in a normal glass with a cork or a screw cap there?
Well, the can offers very good light packaging, so it has advantages in terms of the transport. There's less a better carbon footprint in for the transport, less energy needed because it's lighter. It also has very good cubic efficiency on the shelf, so that you can get a lot of cans in a small cubic area, which means your rate per shelf sale is very, very good.
That's because they're quite narrow cans, aren't they?
Yes.
Whereas if they're big round cans, you'd have quite a lot of void space between the products.
Yeah, and they're almost cubic, so that there's no space that's left over because there's no long neck on the can. So it's very compact.
Oh, okay. Yeah, true. True. I suppose it's a shopper's, Tesco's dream product, really, isn't it?
Well, they like good cubic efficiency, and they do measure that sort of thing against the rate of sales. So it is one of their measures.
Sure. Okay. Let's talk a wee bit about how the can's made up. You said it was almost like an extruded single-piece can with another bit bolted on the top, two pieces, you described it. But it's just not aluminium, is it? There's lots of coatings and all that.
Yep.
What are the coatings that you use?
Well, the main coating that's of interest is the epoxy-based spray-on lining that we use, which is a standard lining that's used throughout the can industry. We apply more of it to protect the can than we would do some of the other products that we make. But it protects the wine from the can and makes sure that we have what goes in comes out of the can. So it's very important in terms of the overall performance and gives the 12-month shelf life that we have.
What about things like dinting the can? I remember reading years ago that things like aluminium was related to Alzheimer's and things like that. Is that
true? No, it's certainly not true. I mean, there have been reports linking to it, but the latest research on that doesn't show a link to that. It's still
who funded the research?
No, that's nothing. The can industry has had nothing to do with any of the funding on that.
Or the aluminium industry?
No, I mean, they've been involved because there are discussions going on, but that is not a point that we consider to be of relevance these days. It has largely been discredited.
Has it? Okay.
And when you think of the number of people using aluminium pots and pans for ordinary cooking,
yeah,
and also the amount of aluminium that you get in a lot of natural foods anyway, it's far in exceeds what there is from the can. And we monitor very carefully the metal pickup as part of the normal process of quality that we have within the product.
If the cans get dented, does that compromise the can at all?
It depends on the size of the dent. If it's really bashed, then it could do. But the lacquers that we use are flexible, so they're made for can formation. We actually bend some of the can during manufacture after it's been sprayed anyway. So they are flexible. So through normal handling, there are no problems.
Okay. And in terms of the format size, you talked about them being quite square and cubic and all that sort of stuff for space efficiency. But they seem to, the ones I've seen are like a single shot. You know, there's enough for me, no one else. Not that I'm greedy. Mind you, I do say that about a 750ml bottle as well. But but the cans, how many mils in one of your cans at the moment that you're looking?
Well, we have been making 250ml cans. That's the standard sort of energy drink size. And people have been using that for wine, putting 250ml in. Some people have used a 200ml and then put 187ml in, which is like a glass and a half. We make 13 different sizes across the group, right from a 1 litre down to the 200ml can. So we really, if there's a market for it, we'll look at manufacturing what the market would like. So we're quite flexible. But it tends to be around those sizes. And there is some legislation in different areas which limits what sort of serving sizes you can put in the can for wine.
Yeah, 250ml, 175, 125.
Yeah.
Sort of standard sizes in the EU.
The EU. And then America has even different sizes. So there's a different set of rules governing that.
Is that why you see strange numbers like 440 mils in cans of Pepsi?
Well, the 440 mils, I think, is a hang back from the beer industry where they used a 16-ounce can. And it goes back to the imperial days and the imperial measurements why they chose those particular things. And it's just buried in the history of how the industry's grown up.
What wines have you got in can at the moment, or have you produced for producers? I saw the Prosecco in can with Paris Hilton, which was probably...
Yeah, the Prosecco has been very popular. People have been using them for spritzers and also fruit-based mixed wine drinks. Those have been very popular.
Coolers.
The cooler-type drinks. We have other French-style wines that are looking at being put in the can. And have been. So we have a number of different people that are interested and are using it. So throughout Europe, the numbers of wine cans that we have been selling have been growing year on year.
Do you think that any particular white or red or sparkling wine or anything like that might be more suited to a can, or do you think it's too early to tell?
Well, the can is seen, I think, generally by people as being a container that chills well and is used to be coming out from the fridge. So I suspect that people will readily take to a sparkling wine or a white wine or indeed a rosé wine. Red might be a bit more of a challenge. We can put red in the can. We have put red in the can, and that's not an issue. But maybe the people would have a little bit more resistance about just having it from out of the can, but all of them are readily available, and we have the technology to can both sparkling and the still wines.
I suppose the two areas we mentioned fairs and concerts and things like that. The other place where this might have an advantage over other bottle sizes is airplanes.
Yes.
Airplanes with because they're quite weight-focused, aren't they?
They're very weight-focused, and that is another opportunity, and we've been speaking to the people who supply the airline trade, because that's the way into that. It's not actually easy to get the airline trade to do that themselves. They rely on their suppliers and the contracts they have as to how they get those wines. But that's certainly an area that would be very interesting, and the can's perfect for that.
How does a can compare to a glass bottle from a recycling point of view?
From a recycling point of view, the can is excellent. It is totally recyclable. So if you put a can in for recycling, it will come back as a can, closed loop. You save energy because we don't have the initial smelting energy, because all you've got to do is remelt it and it comes back as a can. And indeed, where there are closed recycling loops, after you dispose of the can, 60 days later, it can come back as the can again. So it really is a fast loop. The aluminium itself has value, so there is an incentive for people to recycle. People can collect it, take it along to the local scrap merchants, and they will actually get a value for the aluminium.
Oh, so, really? Mm. Okay, and in terms of, like, let's look at the numbers, though. Energy-wise, per 250 mils served, do you know how that compares to a glass bottle?
I think one needs to be very careful, because there are lots of different studies, and they all start from different perspectives. But our view is that the aluminium bottle would compete more favourably than glass, and is a very environmentally friendly container.
I suppose if it is closed loop, it doesn't matter if it's going... Like, one of the problems with glass is a lot of wine is in green glass, which doesn't have any other use apart from green glass bottles, which is for wine. And places like the UK, where we don't actually consume a lot of green glass, you know, we use it and then we try to recycle it, but it can't be consumed or reused. Mm-hmm. It's not really closed loop, whereas it doesn't matter if it's a beer can or a wine can, does it? It can go into a beer bottle or another wine can.
Oh, absolutely. It doesn't matter. It's an aluminium can, and the aluminium can be used for whatever market. We're not really saying either that the can should replace the glass bottle. The glass bottle has its place. What we're saying is that by not the wine industry not taking on board an aluminium can, that perhaps they're missing an opportunity for a wider spread of their product through different channels that they don't currently have. So they're just simply missing opportunities by not including the aluminium can within their portfolio.
Okay, then. I think we'll wrap it up there, Graham.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed that interview with Graham. Rex and cans, or putting wine into a can, bit of a strange one. One of the things I didn't mention in there is, obviously, it's sealed, and there's no oxygen getting in there, so it's very similar to a Stalvin cap and a glass bottle. So the same issues such as reduction are probably likely to occur in these cans. But given that they are hermetically sealed, it's unlikely that much sulfur dioxide is going to be used. So if you're into this biodynamic wines, maybe aluminium cans are the right way to go. Although, again, I doubt if they'll think about that. It's not very natural and biodynamic, is it? Right, okay, let's finish up with, and our mystery region was, of course, Chile's Central Valley. Now, the Central Valley is the source of the majority of the country's wines. It's a 1,000-kilometre plateau which is separated from the Pacific Ocean to the west by a low coastal range of peaks, while to the east is the mighty Andes. Red grapes such as Cabernet Sauvignon, Carmenere, Merlot and Syrah dominate, but Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay are also important. Divided into four subregions, Maipo, Rapel, Curico and Mole, soils are varied depending on the area and there are distinctions climate-wise. Generally, however, the Central Valley is the Mediterranean with warm, dry summers and winter rainfall. Hope that clears that one up. Just to finish up with this week, we have our mystery quote. And this week's quote is from old Bill Shakespeare, William Shakespeare, from Othello. Good wine is a good familiar creature, if well used. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.